Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and oh my goodness, it's so good to be home in the Pacific Northwest, and we have got a lot of fun. Yes, spooky fun we're going to be sharing with you today, but the fun is real, yes, and being a native, not a native, but a person that's lived in the Pacific Northwest since 1980, our guest today, Athena, is going to be sharing with us her experiences about the ghosts of Seattle, Washington. And oh my goodness, we do have an abundance of them. Athena, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Now, you're down in Oregon.
I am. I'm in Portland currently.
You're in Portland. Now, I want you to give my audience a little bit about your background and why it is you became interested in researching the spooks of Seattle.
Well, I have to be perfectly honest and say I accidentally tripped and fell into that gig.
You did? How did you trip and fall?
I did. I misread an article, somebody looking for a ghostwriter, and I was looking for a way to make extra money for school as I'm a writer. So I applied to it, and she liked my samples and asked me if I could do ghost stories of Seattle. And I said, oh, ghost stories. I thought you meant ghost writer.
Uh-huh.
So I went to Seattle purely, I guess, open-minded. I was curious to see what they had available in the realm of the folklore and the legendary and mythology. So I had no prior background up until then.
Now, right at the beginning of your book, and I'm going to share this with my audience, you have a quote by Chief Seattle, which I thought was a wonderful, wonderful way to introduce your book. And this is what he said. The sable braves and fond mothers and glad-hearted maidens and the little children who lived and rejoiced here and whose very names are now forgotten still love these solitudes and their deep fastness at eventide grows shadowy with the presence of dusky spirits. And when the last red man shall have perished from the earth and his memory among white men shall have become a myth, these shores shall swarm with the invisible dead of my tribe, and when your children's children shall think themselves alone in the field, the store, the shop, upon the highway, or in the silence of the woods, they will not be alone. In all the earth, there is no place dedicated to solitude. At night, when the streets of your cities and villages shall be silent, and you think them deserted, they will throng with a returning host that once filled and still loved this beautiful land. The white man will never be alone. Let him be just and deal kindly with my people, for the dead are not altogether powerless. Chief Seattle. I like that as an introduction to your book.
Thank you.
And I just had a wonder, you know, you gave so much good information. And Seattle obviously was named after Chief Seattle. And you say that he's mentioned in a number of paranormal stories by different people, which wouldn't surprise me at all. And you have a story about his daughter, Princess Angeline.
Yes.
And we'll get into that. But I want to start off with something you had right in the beginning, because we are known for a very liquid environment around here, coming from the skies as well as from the earth. And you bring that up. You talk about a French immunologist, Jacques Buenaveste, who in 1988 said that he had discovered a scientific explanation for homeopathy.
Correct.
And you also talk about Masaru Emoto.
Yes.
Give us the background on that and why you chose to bring that into part of your story.
Well, when I got the Ghosts of Seattle gig, I didn't really have any previous experience with ghosts, per se, and the research involved in it. So So I sort of immersed myself in the theories and the mythologies and what I might be encountering as I moved to Seattle to do my research. And Masaru Emoto's work, Messages from Water, was so utterly fascinating to me about the ability for water to retain the possibility of emotion or energy. I also researched, I watched a lot of the show Taps, and I was really fascinated by their concept that a lot of hauntings take place near water, and I wanted to know why. And also they brought up that there's a lot of hauntings near quartz veins or quarries, and I wanted to know why. So I had a lot of those things in the back of my mind as I set out, but the water, since Seattle is such a wet environment between Lake Washington and Elliott Bay and all of the rainfall, I wanted to know how that plays into the level of the hauntings. And the only other comparable cities in the United States for the amounts of hauntings that are available all happen in very wet environments, especially New Orleans and New York and several other places that have the highest quantity of the paranormal activity. So I wanted to know how that played in, and because I wasn't there to prove or disprove ghosts, I was mostly there to find the lore and the folklore and the mythologies and the legends and see what's worth repeating. I had to keep that sort of in the back of my mind as the possibility that that might contribute in some way.
You have had a couple of experiences. Now, you said you really didn't, you've not actively gone after anything in the paranormal prior to this research that you did.
Correct.
However, you did have a couple of your own experiences when you were 12 years of age. And one
True.
Was about your Uncle John. Tell us about that.
Well, my Uncle John, I was not very frequently in contact with Uncle John, but I knew who he was and I had seen him regularly. And when I was about 12, I was in northern Utah with my family, and we were driving from Smithfield, or Logan to Smithfield, which is about 10 or 15 minutes. And my Uncle John resided in Provo, which is 3.5 hours north, south, pardon me. And we stopped at a gas station at the halfway point between Smithfield and Logan. And I looked over out the window, and to my right, Uncle John was standing next to me, next to the gas pump. And I asked my cousin next to me, I said, why is Uncle John there? How did Uncle John get there? And she looked out the window and didn't see anybody. And by the look on her face, clearly that I was crazy, I shut my mouth and didn't say anything about it after that until we got home another 7 or 8 minutes later. And as we pulled into the driveway, the phone was ringing at my aunt's house. So she ran in and answered the phone, and it was Uncle John's wife calling from Provo to say that Uncle John had just died on the operating table of a massive heart attack and that he had been under for 4 minutes and then been revived. But it coincided with the time that I thought I had seen him at the gas pump. So that was really the first initiation into something being a little bit, not paranormal per se, but unexplainable to me at the time. I wasn't really sure what that meant. And my sense of reality was that was the first big challenge.
Now, your second one was over at a friend's house. You've got to share what that one was, too.
Well, it was actually approximately the same time. I was about 12 years old, and we were playing at a friend's house. I had gone in. We walked in, me and a friend walked in, and all the hair on the back of my neck stood up. My arms stood up, full body shiver and chill, and I felt frozen to place with this utter sense of terror, something I couldn't explain, something I didn't understand. It felt like my chest was being pried open with a crowbar. And it was painful and it was scary, and I also couldn't really move my body. And I managed to roll my eyes and my head enough to see her, who was standing next to me, and by the look on her face, something was not quite right either. So as soon as we both had the ability to move, we ran. We ran out the front door, out the lawn, and down the street to the park where we sat on the swing sets and just cried because it was very emotional and neither of us could explain it. And the girl who lived there followed us and caught up to us at the park. And I always remember how she explained it as, it's nothing you should worry about. It's just my brother who died. And he comes around this time every year. And I explained to her, I said, no, it was decidedly unfriendly. And then as we talked about it, she told the story about her older brother who was 9 years older than her. And he was joking around one day several years earlier and trying to tease the babysitter by pretending to hang himself from the upstairs balcony with the dog chain, and accidentally hung himself, and he was too heavy for her to pull back up. So he died in the house, and my friend believes that he continues to haunt the house. And I said, no, it was very unfriendly, like dangerous unfriendly. And she said, well, there are a lot of stories about how the house used to be a sorority house and how there was some kind of devil-worshipping party and, you know, people overdosed and died on the property. And when I was 12 years old and I was living in Utah, it was anything that was chalked up to, everything was chalked up to devil worship. Mm-hmm. There was never any other explanation other than if something went wrong, it clearly was the devil. So I grew up with that sense of, oh, it must have been devil worship. But now as I'm older and I look back on it, it could very well have just been, you know, an average college party gotten out of hand and a couple of girls OD'd on something.
Mm-hmm.
No devil work required.
Right.
But that was my second experience, and it really challenged, again, my sense of safety and my a little bit of the realm of what I could comprehend and understand about my energetic boundaries. And my dad pulled me aside as I told him this great fear I had of, you know, the stories about the devil and church and so on and so forth. And basically his explanation to me was that whatever you fear will find a way to get you, so you have to overcome your fear. And gave me some chants and some prompts and things that I could say to feel better. And I'm not entirely sure if he just, you know, made those up for a little girl who was scared, or, you know, if there was any, you know, resonance or power behind them, really, but other than what we imbue into those words.
Mm-hmm.
But they worked for me when I was young, and I didn't have any recurring incidences afterwards.
So here you are. You had those experiences when you were quite young.
Yep.
And now you're in Seattle, and you're doing all of this wonderful research, and you had no clue about what you were going to be experiencing. And you met
sure.
up with someone by the name of Jake. And she
had
quite a gal. Now, how did you choose Jake to be your tour guide? By the way, for those of you listening, we're talking with Athena, who is out of Portland, Oregon, and her wonderful book, Ghosts of Seattle. And I just said, we've got to talk about this. This is home turf here. Can't pass up on all the spooks in the area. This is too good. So now here you are. How did you connect with Jake?
I found Jake on the internet through Private Eye Tours, and I believed as I was making my reservation that Jake would be a man. I didn't understand at the time that Jake is a term for private detective. And so Jake is in fact a very beautiful woman. So I found Jake on the internet. I liked her tours and the way that the website talked. And because I wasn't really familiar with Seattle, even though I live in Portland, I would be moving there for the extent of my research, which would take about 6 months. And so I was happy to have somebody else do the driving while I learned the layouts of the streets and, you know, heard sort of what the locals thought of their ghosts in town. So I found her on the internet. I think it's privateeyetours.com.
All right, so here we are with Jake. Now, she took you to a number of places. One is the Arctic Club. Now,
yes.
The Arctic Club is in downtown Seattle, and there are some ghost stories about a U.S. Congressman, Marion A. Zionchek. Tell us what happened there, and why were you taken to the Arctic Club?
Well, the Arctic Club is on, I believe, on 3rd and Cherry Street, and it's originally... it's got these beautiful walrus statuesque pieces on the outside of the third floor. And Zionchek was a congressman who, there's still a lot of controversy, even to this day, 70 years later, whether he was murdered or whether he, in fact, killed himself. So because there's so much debate about it still and so much of the conspiracy theory, I think the legend sort of evolves and gets moodier every time it's told. But he evidently stepped out of the race under a great deal of pressure, and his friend took his place and won the next election. And he wrote a note saying that he couldn't take it. All he really wanted to do was to help people. And evidently, at that point, threw himself out the fifth story window, where he landed on the sidewalk down below, where his wife Ruby was waiting in the car. So evidently she saw him fall to his death, and her brother, his brother-in-law, was in the office when he threw himself out. So therein lies the controversy of whether or not he, you know, was he actually pushed or did he jump voluntarily. And since then, there's been several sightings of orb activity, difficulties with the elevator, lights flickering on and off, and other such paranormal activity for the last 70 years.
Now, you went into a cemetery or two as well, and you got to know some people who are ghost hunters in the Seattle area. And one of the admonitions they gave you was to never do anything by yourself. Go alone, and especially when you were thinking of going to the Comet Lodge Cemetery. Now, what made this so effective? In fact, in your book you said, the stories are so interesting, some of which could be right out of the movie Poltergeist. Okay, give us what was going on.
Well, evidently, the cemetery, Comet Lodge Cemetery, was originally a five-acre plot. And it actually had the graves for most of the hospital's dead up on Beacon Hill. Well, over the years, somehow the plot lines were redrawn, and three of the acres were sold to a private development company. Well, the city forgot the plat lines. The developers went ahead and put 12 houses down. And the other 2 acres of the 5-acre plat were lost under, you know, blackberry bramble and trees and whatnot and forgotten. And during the 70s, when these houses went up, there was a lot of paranormal activity that took place in these houses, such as mostly involving children, which is not, you know, surprising considering that most of the hospital dead were children. But A lot of the houses that had children reported that their toys would end up being scattered in the middle of the night, even though they were put away the night before. One little boy claimed that even though he put his toys away every time he was told to put his toys away, in the morning they would wake up and there would be toys on the steps and toys in the living room, and he would be chastised, and he would tell his parents every time that it was the other little boy that took the toys out of the box and put them everywhere, and the little boy was dressed kind of strangely and would sit at the end of his bed. And he thought that this strange little boy wanted to play with him. There was a story also in that neighborhood where a woman who was very fond of her beautiful antique dolls had an expensive display case made with a lock, and every morning she would wake up and the dolls were moved out of the expensive display case and either scattered around the house or put on different shelves, even though the lock was a very good lock. So there's the stories of the Comet Lodge Cemetery area. Sort of invoked or encouraged people to search out the paranormal a little bit more. There were stories of incandescent children playing or the laughter of children in what was remaining of the graveyard. And when the city decided to bulldoze the 2 acres that was still left over and put down a dog park, a lot of the residents, well, one resident actually, who remembered that it was actually a cemetery, started a protest, and they had an emergency cleanup party to come in and pull out the bramble and try and rearrange, you know, the cemetery so that it wouldn't be bulldozed. And they did succeed. What's left of Comet Lodge Cemetery is only 2 acres.
So there we go with that. But not only did you have the cemetery, which I understand you opted not to stay there alone overnight.
Yes.
That was a good thing, I believe. We've got the Harvard Exit Theater. It was built in 1925 and was given landmark status in 1979. Give us a little bit of history, because there's the Woman's Century Club that was founded in 1891, and that had to do with the beginning of the feminist movement in Seattle. But this is quite a place. Give us the information on the theater, the Harvard Exit Theater.
The Harvard Exit Theater was one of my very favorite places to research. A very beautiful structure with a lot of the old Victorian, you know, gilt and beautiful ornate, you know, craftsmanship that you don't see anymore. When I went into the Harvard Exit Theater, I was totally blown away. I had no idea what to be expecting. I was not expecting a 1920s lobby with a full fireplace and a baby grand piano and cushy couches. I was totally enchanted. And it's Bertha Knights Landes was the first female mayor of Seattle. And she was the president of the Women's Century Club for many, many years. And this was sort of, from what I gather from the research, this was her home. This was her place of safety and nurturement to the other women who came here to pursue women's rights and suffragism. I'm sorry, that's not the right word for that, the suffragist movement. And she, I believe, created a sort of energy that exists still in that place that's very wholesome and creative. And I took the tour with a man who took me down through the downstairs, and as he walked me through it, he was wearing a top hat and a brocade coat, and we went through all the different levels. And as you go into the basement, it's still unfinished, and there's layers of history there, couches and bikes from every different era. And the deeper you go down into the boiler room and everything, he starts to tell this story about how the building itself was built on a house where a man had been murdered. I could not find anything to verify that story and in all of my research. So I have to chalk that one up to urban legend. But the most persistent stories that come out of the Harvard Exit Theater are on the upper floors, where women are seen in turn-of-the-century Victorian gowns. They're completely intact, except they're missing their face or their hands or their feet. Oftentimes, I've heard stories about people who come in to light the fireplace, and the fireplace is already going, and that at one point, an employee came in to light the fireplace and saw somebody sitting in one of the couches in front of the fireplace. And as she came by, this woman stood up, and the employee later identified her as Bertha Knight Blandes from a photograph that Bertha Knight walked past her and walked out with a smile and shut the light off as she went. So there's a lot of really beautiful, I believe, beautiful stories that are attached to the Harvard Exit Theater.
Stories like that are so much fun.
Aren't they, though?
Especially when you have employees that have experienced them, and they'll say, I will not do this or I will not do that because of this, that, or so experience. We have a restaurant in Silicon, Washington, that the owners of the restaurant never want anybody to know that the employees refuse to go up in the attic because of all the commotion. It's built in a Victorian mansion that has been a restaurant for a number of years. So it's almost as if there is a pact among the employees, if we go, it's all or none. Because they've had so many experiences. And, of course, this is so much fun to talk about because Halloween is just around the corner.
Yeah, it's perfect timing for that.
It is perfect timing. Now, let's talk about one of the significant areas. Let's go, because of timing. I want to go to Pike's Market.
Oh, good.
That is a landmark of landmarks. It's one of my most favorite places in Seattle. And Pike's Place Market is absolutely incredibly rich with lore. And tell us about Chief Seattle's daughter.
Princess Angeline, at about the time that Pike's Place Market was being established, originally the ground where Pike's Place Market is situated is supposed to be a place where it was a safety place to come and trade with all the other tribes. So before it was Pike's Place Market, it was considered an Indian trading ground, which is holy in the sense that no crime can be committed there. It's all supposed to be fair trade and equal. Well, as Pike's Place Market was established in 1907, a lot of the natives were being pushed out of the city. And Princess Angeline was very good friends with Gessler. And so thereby established sort of her ability to stay. She just flat out refused to leave, basically. And because she was friends with Gessler, she was sort of, I think, indulged. And she had beautiful blue eyes, by all accounts, and which was very unusual for a native. And she lived in a little shack where she did a lot of beadwork and laundry and was very well known to the people in the area. Somewhere along this time, this rumor got started after Princess Angeline died that if you saw Princess Angeline, you would die shortly thereafter. I was never able to verify those rumors. In fact, most of the stories of people I encountered, or even, you know, third-hand stories, most of the people who claim to have seen Princess Angeline feel very blessed afterwards, like she's bestowed upon them some sort of grace. And there were stories about how if Princess Angeline, if anybody was trading in the market, and they were being cheated, Princess Angeline would show up and stop the cheating from happening. So she was sort of like a goodwill ambassador. There are a lot of stories that I feel like misalign the spirit of Princess Angeline, because, like I said, I couldn't find anything to say that anything she's done is bad. One story is a couple that was getting married in a church downtown. They were in the ceremony when a woman came in dressed in rags, her face down, and she shuffled in. And the father of the bride got up and, you know, insisted that somebody throw the bag lady out and was very, very rude. And then, you know, they throw out Princess Angeline with the beautiful blue eyes, this old lady, and then all these stories about how the father of the bride died a horrible death afterwards could never be verified. None of that could be verified to me. But it's interesting in the retelling because I feel like it says a lot about the culture of the market. And the market is very, very rich in all sorts of stories. But there, to this day, have not been any real serious stories of anybody being in any harm's way. All of the stories are trickster stories or protector stories or guardian stories or playful spirit stories. The market is very nestled in the sense of cooperative agreement. And so it seems like all the spirits that are actually encountered in the market are very agreeable spirits.
That's the truth. And the market itself, people come from all over the world.
Yes.
To be able to have their photo taken here at this phenomenal facility, and vendors come in from all over to sell their independent wares, and there's the fish market, the tea market. Let's talk about the bookstore ghost that's there.
Yes, but there was a story about a book that would always be open on the floor in the morning when the bookstore owner would come in. And she would put the book away, and the next morning it would be back on the floor. And that was the bookstore that's just down the hall from, I believe it's Grandma's Attic.
Yes.
So it's the bookstore down the hall from that. And actually, the woman who runs Grandma's Attic was telling me that story as well, about the book that kept reappearing. Grandma's Attic has several stories of her own, or display cases that were cracked or opened, even though the door was locked and the toys had been played with. And then just up from Grandma's Attic is the bead zone, where there's a playful spirit, which they believe is a boy named Jacob, who comes in and plays with the beads at night when nobody is there. And sometimes even when people are there, all the beads get rearranged in different containers.
Oh, it's wonderful for business, because it's just absolutely fascinating. You just don't know where these ghosts are going to pop up and bring their own special magic. My guest today has been Athena, who, as she puts it, had a gig opportunity to write about ghosts, and that is what she's done. These are ghosts of Seattle, and it's absolutely charming, all of the stories. There are so many, many more, including one about Ted Bundy and a few other very unsavory characters. Now, Athena, is there a website where people can go to find out more information about your wonderful book, The Ghosts of Seattle?
Currently, the only website attachment I have is wisegoddess.com, and that will be updated with more information on Ghosts of Seattle as the month progresses.
Oh.
We're still in the marketing stage of the release.
All right, so this is wisegoddess.com. And you'll find all this wonderful information about the book and some other delicious tidbits that I'm sure you'll enjoy. If you're into ghosts, believe me, this is a book you'll want to read. And having lived in the area since 1980, I love it all. I just think it's fabulous. Athena, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's a lot of fun. And, boy, if nothing else, you could invite people over and just have them sit around, turn the lights down, and read by candlelight until they're just absolutely shaking in the boots.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Oh, it's been a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. Don't forget, The Ghosts of Seattle by Athena, and her website is wisegoddess.com. Go there and get her information. We're going to take a break, and we come back. Ooh, I have some ghoulish goodies that you might want to fix up. Oh, I know, but it's so much fun around Halloween. Don't go away. We have more good things to share with you here on the Donna Sebo Show. We're going to be back in just a moment.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Oh, it feels so good to be back in my own home turf here in the Pacific Northwest. And, of course, Halloween is just around the corner, and it is so much fun to chat about ghosts and spooks and all kinds of things. And when I was getting ready to leave New York, I was leaving in the morning yesterday, and I have to be up quite early to be able to get to the airport, you know, with all the new rules and regulations. You have to be there 2 hours ahead of time, and then you have to get a shuttle. So I was up, you know, about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was down in the hotel lobby waiting for the shuttle to take me to the airport for my early a.m. flight home. And it was more fun. I was watching all of these characters, and I mean characters, that were coming in to the hotel, because this past weekend a lot of people were partying. Since they wouldn't be able to do it during the week, they were doing it on the weekend. So Superman was in the lobby, and we had a few witches floating around and some odd characters of one type or another. And the people of New York just have a great sense of humor, and they were having such a tremendous time. Those that I saw, they were in just about anything and everything when it came to costuming, and they were having an absolute blast. So this was still at 3 or 4 in the morning on Sunday, and it was just, it was really entertaining to watch all of it. And I know so many of you, you're going to be having parties for kids. If you've not done it this weekend, there may be something special in your neighborhood. My husband has such fond memories of the Halloween time when he was growing up, because they used to have block parties when he was a kid. And he said everybody in the neighborhood got involved. They'd block off the street so that everybody could be out dancing, or they'd have the games. They'd bob for apples. They have all kinds of stuff. And the parents were just as much involved as the kids. And, of course, it was a wonderful challenge of coming up with costumes. When he was growing up, he said we didn't have a whole bunch of money to spend, so we had to use a lot of imagination and had to be extremely creative. So they just had a great, great time. It was a lot of fun. And he said, of course, the moms would fix up all kinds of goodies to eat, and the dads were helping with the games. So it was very much a family event. And I think in many respects, many neighborhoods are starting to get back into that feel, so that there can be that interaction, there can be the involvement, because I can have such, oh, I have such fond memories of the Halloween period when I was growing up, because we didn't have the block parties, but we had events at school and had all kinds of activities. It was just a lot of fun. And I know there are many people that have attitudes about Halloween, but I think it's terrific. I just think it's absolutely great. I think you can have a fabulous time. And, in fact, I've got to share with you Green Guts Meatloaf. Oh, doesn't that just make your day? I've got the picture of this stuff in front of me, and I just love it. People have such wonderful imagination. So if I have time today, if I don't do it today, I'll do it tomorrow. The Guts Meatloaf. Okay, let's talk about carving a pumpkin, because that is something, my goodness, when I'm out walking my dogs, I'm seeing pumpkins all over the place. People have all of these wonderful displays. Here in the Pacific Northwest, people are so enthusiastic about Halloween. So they decorate their front porches, their front yards, their lawns. There's one home that's got this gigantic spider. I mean, I'm not kidding. Legs from end to end are like 6 feet across, and they've got it around in their entry area to their house. All of this wonderful, wonderful imagination. Well, if you want to carve a perfect pumpkin, if you haven't done it yet and you really want to help the kids work with something, it's real easy to do. Now, here are some tips from a guy that really knows his stuff. His name is Gene Granata. And he said, when you pick your pumpkin, you want to choose one that's wider, smooth, and has sort of a flat face to it, and not a whole bunch of ridges in it, so that you, if you're going to do the carving, you can draw your design, it's going to look okay, and if you're helping your youngster with it, it's easier to work with. And, of course, you've got all kinds of sizes that you can work with today. And he said, also look for a thick skin, because that's going to be easier for you to carve. And then he has some suggestions about preparing. He said, carve an opening from the bottom, not the top, because the lid can fall in when it shrivels, and it does. You know, if you put a lamp or a candle, depending on what you want to use, the heat would automatically cause the pumpkin to start to shrivel up on the inside. Now, when you're scooping out the inside of the pumpkin, be sure you leave about 1 inch thick of the shell. You want to have that. And you can use a melon baller for small pumpkins and a serving spoon for the large ones when you want to scoop out the inside. And all you have to do is draw your design with a grease pencil. You can rub off any mistakes with a paper towel if you make them, and with a little bit of oil. Or you can use a store-bought or homemade carving pattern. And you use tape, of course, to keep the pattern once you put that paper piece on the pumpkin, keep it in place. Now, you want to use the smallest, thinnest knife that you own. And if you want to have safer, easier cutting, there's a pumpkin carving tool set that you can buy. Isn't it amazing what they've done to make this so convenient? And all you have to do is carve the smaller details first to keep your pumpkin from breaking. And that is a very interesting point. So if you've got a real detailed pattern, remember, do the smaller details first. Also, if you choose a pumpkin with a flat bottom so it sits straight, it won't rock on you. Then, when you want to light up your pumpkin, try using battery-operated candles. One, they won't generate heat, and they won't shrivel your pumpkin. Now, here in the Pacific Northwest, it's pretty damp and cool right now. We're in the fall. Trees are changing color really, really fast. In fact, we have buku bucket loads of leaves all over the place because we've had some good winds come through and knocking off the dead leaves. But the pumpkins stay good around here for a long time because we have cooler temperatures. But if you're in drier temperatures, your pumpkin will start to shrivel and look sort of strange. But if you use your batteries on the inside, you're not going to have the shrinkage and the distortion. And just have fun with it. Now, out here in the Northwest, I don't know what you do with your old pumpkins. But, you know, there's raccoons out where we are and all kinds of critters that will actually eat the pumpkin itself. So it will decompose. And if you have a composter of any kind, just remember you can toss it into your composter and it can be recycled. So it can make your fertilizer that you make on your own to make your garden rich and lush. But, oh, it's so much fun. So carving a perfect pumpkin is easy. It's fun to do. And kids just have a blast. And it just really is so warm and welcoming. And they're so inexpensive. It's just a lot of fun. And with all the designs and the things that people can do, it just adds that special magic. I know it's really been fun walking around the neighborhood just seeing what people are doing. So I hope you have a good time with that. By the way, I was talking about kids and carving pumpkins. Well, your kids also are going to be in school, and they're going to be very busy preparing for tests. Now, before I give you some information on education with kids that I have in front of me, I do want to let you know telephone lines are open. If you'd like to call and chat with me today, it's real easy. We have toll-free telephone numbers for you to call into. In the U.S., just dial 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial. Of course, I would love to know where you're calling from. And then after that, just let me do my thing. I'll give you my mental impressions, and you're welcome to ask me a question about anything you like. And remember, I consider myself an information resource, and so it is fun, it's interesting, and if you're a new listener to the Donna Sebo Show, I'm delighted you have the opportunity to join us. Tell your friends and give me a buzz if you would like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. Oh, by the way, I want to thank the people at the National Publicity Summit. I had the wonderful opportunity of being on their panel of presenters. Also, I met a number of people. There were 100 people that attended, authors from all over the country, and we are going to be hearing from some of those authors on future opportunities after the first of the year, who are going to be guests on my show, and I'm really looking forward to having them. So just know that I want to say again thank you to those of you that I met at the Publicity Summit. It was a real pleasure, and I appreciate the staff and the hosts of that event. They've invited me over the past few years, and it's always a delight to interact with them and to meet so many wonderful people who have something to say that can make a difference in our everyday lives. And that's what the Donna Sebo Show is all about, bringing you information that's going to educate you, it's going to make you aware of things, provide some entertainment, I hope, and also make you aware that there's a lot more in this world that's going on than you ever dreamed. Okay, I was talking about kids having tests, and I think that that's just a part of life. We have to realize that when we're in school, we're going to have these tests. But if you really want to help your kids because you can't take the test for them, remember some things that are really important. And, of course, as we get into the winter months, it's not as difficult to get the kids to go to bed early. But if they're a TV fan, it might be. Remember, the kids need their sleep. They need a good 8 hours of sleep. They found in research that if they get less than that in sleep, their stress hormone, cortisol, increases by 50%. And, you know, it causes anxiety. And don't let them stay up late to cram for tests. Now, I know kids have often done that. I can remember doing it. But it doesn't work quite frequently. So encourage them to do their homework, do their studying, get their sleep before they take the exam. And also, they need to have a good breakfast before they go into school. Studies at England's Bristol University found that breakfast eaters usually were a lot less stressed than those that would skip breakfast. And they said cereals or oatmeal are some of the best things that you possibly can serve your kids. And if you use bananas, they're great because they're very nutritious. They have potassium, fiber, and the amino acid tryptophan, which they all increase relaxation. And tell your kids to visualize getting a real good grade on their test. They said when they do positive visualization like that, they create alpha waves, and again, it's associated with relaxation. And they said just imagine that, or have them imagine that they're going to ace their test. And also, as a special treat, maybe slip some chocolate into the lunchbox, because dark chocolate contains plant chemicals that increase concentration and decrease anxiety. And you know what? It's a nice tradition to start. If you know they're going to have a test day, say, got something special in your lunchbox for you, and put a treat like that in. Those are some suggestions by some people that have been involved with education, like Sean Talbot and also Tracy Woods. They said kids need to know that they've got to get their sleep, eat well before they have a test, and get rewarded when they do well. Also, don't forget, we have the phone lines open here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat with me, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. This is Donna Sebo, and I'll be glad to chat with you and light up your life with a little bit of insight. If you don't want to call, talk, hey, I got a Green Guts meatloaf that just may make your day. We'll come back in just a minute. Don't go away.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss, book and talking book audio are only $19.95, plus shipping and handling. And the author, Donna Sebo, will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Okay, I promised you a Green Guts meatloaf. I know, but this really is, this would be so much fun to pull on your kids. Or, you know, if you had a relative you didn't like and it's Halloween. I mean, anything goes, whatever. But you can make this dish without the green. But why? If you're going to have fun, have fun. Now, this is what you're going to need. You're going to need 8 ounces of long fusilli. Pasta, 8 ounces of long fusilli. You're going to need 1 teaspoon of liquid green food coloring, 1 teaspoon of liquid green food coloring, 1 pound of ground beef, 1 pound of ground beef, 1 1/3 cups of marinara sauce, 1 1/3 cups of marinara sauce. You're going to need one egg, 1/2 cup of frozen peas, 1/2 cup of frozen peas. Of course, they need to be thawed. And then 2 tablespoons of dried breadcrumbs, 2 tablespoons of dried breadcrumbs, and 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh parsley, 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh parsley, and 1/4 teaspoon of pepper. Okay, now the pasta, you just go ahead and cook it like you would normally cook it. Just follow the directions on the package. And you add the green food coloring to the water, the boiling water. And just let it do its thing. And then the noodles will all turn the wiggly, you know, creepy self. And just then drain it. And then while the noodles are cooking, you want to preheat your oven to about 350 degrees. And you want to coat a 1 1/2 quart oven-proof bowl with nonstick cooking spray. Then you want to mix the ground beef with 1/3 cup of your marinara sauce, the egg, the peas, the breadcrumbs, the chopped parsley, and pepper. And you then just want to mix that all together. Now, this is what you do. You take that oven-proof bowl, that 1 1/2 quart bowl, and the pasta, which is already cooked, you know, you've mixed your meat and all your stuff, and the pasta is cooking, and so it's all done. And then you take and you run your pasta under the water until it's cool enough to handle. And, of course, it's green and wiggly, yes. So what you want to do, you want to drain that, and then you want to line that bowl that's been sprayed with a nonstick cooking spray. You want to line the bowl with the pasta and then fill the center with ground with your ground meat mixture. Now, you're going to bake it for about 1 hour and 10 minutes or until the meat is no longer pink in the center. Then you let it stand for about 10 minutes. And then you unmold it onto a serving platter. And you just keep it, you know, warm up your remaining marinara sauce, and then you serve it with the meatloaf on the side. What fun that could be. I've got a picture of this when it's served, and I'll tell you what, it looks horrific. But I bet your kids would just absolutely love it. But it's a fun thing to serve at a party if you're having, let's say, a buffet, something like this. The mind just goes wacko. When you have things like this, it's just really a lot of fun. So anyway, that is your Green Guts meatloaf. You could fix the same dish, just don't put the food coloring in with your noodles, and nobody would know the difference. Okay, this is Donna Siebel. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227, Canada 888-815-9756. Oh, I've got to let you know who's going to be coming on air with me this week. Now, today we were talking about spooks. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how you can use stress to fuel your success. Aha, how does that sound to you? Pete Siegel is going to be my guest. He's got some wonderful information that I think will assist all of us. And then on Halloween Eve, we're going to be talking about the story of the Halloween Fairy with Lisa Shodlanza Johnson, and she is just a doll. We are going to have a good time with that. We'll share all kinds of good stories with you. By the way, if you have a fun Halloween story, send it to me to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Then we're going to be talking about a subject on Thursday that most of us are very much aware of, toxicity. Well, we're going to find out about what's toxic and what is not with Gary Ginsberg. He's going to be my guest. And also we're going to be talking about the ABCs of writing winning business plans. Garrett Sutton is my expert that we're going to be discussing this with. If you're thinking of going into business, if you're curious, if you've never done this before, I don't think you're going to want to miss this because we've got a great lineup of guests and wonderful, wonderful information. So I look forward to you joining me all this week for some insightful things. Now, again, I want to thank those of you that have sent emails to me. Regrettably, I have got hundreds of them to respond to. My travel schedule has been so intense this month of October, but I'm getting to them little by little. And I want to thank Debbie for sending me this wonderful, wonderful animal story. If you are a pet lover like I am, this is really going to touch your heart and mind in a very special way. Well, this is about a woman by the name of Mary. She and her husband, Jim, had a dog named Lucky. And Lucky was a real character. Whenever they had company come over to their home for a weekend visit, they would always warn their friends to not leave their luggage open because Lucky would help himself to whatever struck his fancy. Inevitably, someone would forget, and guess what? Get home, something was missing from their suitcase. Mary or Jim would then have to go to Lucky's toy box after their friends had called them saying, you know what, I'm missing a shoe, I'm missing this, I'm missing that. They would go to Lucky's toy box, which was in their basement, and by golly, they'd always find the missing item, because to Lucky it was a treasure, and he had a lot of other favorite toys, but each and everything he claimed was his favorite. Now, he always stashed his finds right there in the toy box, and he was very particular about the fact that his toys stay in his toy box. Now, as it happened, one day Mary found out she had breast cancer, and she was very, very concerned. Everything inside of her was very fatalistic, her emotions. She said she just knew she was going to die of this disease. It was fatal. There was nothing that was going to be able to help her. Now, even though she had all of these feelings, she scheduled the doubled mastectomy that the doctors recommended, she was terrified. She said the night before she was to go into the hospital, she cuddled with her dog, Lucky, and a thought struck her. Oh, my goodness, what's going to happen to my wonderful friend, Lucky? Although the 3-year-old dog loved Jim, Mary's husband, he was Mary's dog through and through. And her thought was, if I die, Lucky's going to be abandoned. He won't understand that I didn't want to leave him. And this made her very sad because she was contemplating that she was going to be dying. Now, the double mastectomy was harder on her than her doctors had anticipated, and she was in the hospital for well over 2 weeks. Now, Jim took Lucky for his walk every day faithfully, but the little dog just drooped and was whining. He was just miserable. Finally, Mary was able to come home, and she was so exhausted she couldn't even make it up the steps to their bedroom. So Jim made sure his wife was comfortable on the couch and left her to nap. Now, Lucky stood watching Mary, but he would not come to her when she called. This made Mary very sad, but due to the medication, she soon was asleep on the couch, and she was in a deep sleep. Now, there came a time when she awakened, but she couldn't understand what was wrong. She couldn't move her head. Her body felt terribly heavy, and she began to panic. And then, when she calmed down, she started to laugh, because she realized what the problem was. She was covered, literally blanketed, with every treasure that Lucky owned. While she had been asleep, the sorrowing dog had made trip after trip to the basement, bringing his beloved mistress all his favorite things in life. He had covered her with his love. She forgot about dying. Instead, she and her wonderful pal Lucky began living again, walking further and further every day. That was 12 years ago. And today, Mary is still cancer-free. Lucky, well, he still has his treasures and stashes them in his toy box. But Mary is the greatest. He loves her the best. This is Donna Sebo. I know we were out of time. It is wonderful to be back again in Home Turf. Thank you for sending me your stories. I will share them as I can. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Enjoy this day. It is a great day to be alive. You have so much inside of you that's just busting to shine and to express itself. Have fun with life. It's a good thing to do, and you'll be healthier and happier for it. Remember Mary and Lucky. Bye for now. Talk with you tomorrow.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.